Hey there. Did you know Kroger always gives you savings and rewards on top of our lower than low prices? And when you download the Kroger app, you'll enjoy over $500 in savings every week with digital coupons. And don't forget fuel points to help you save up to $1 per gallon at the pump. Want to save even more? With a Boost membership, you'll get double fuel points and free delivery. So shop and save big at Kroger today. Kroger, fresh for everyone. Savings may vary by state. Restrictions apply. See site for details.
Hello, everyone. I'm Jinx Monsoon, and welcome to another episode of Hi Jinx with Jinx Monsoon. Today, our guest is celebrated actress, film creator, and directrix, Carrie Preston. We talk about everything from vampires to that time I played her in a sketch, all the way to what it feels like to be a redhead in this industry. So settle in and hunker down for some more hijinks.
Forever Dog.
Hello, everyone. I'm Jinx Monsoon, and welcome to Hi Jinx, a podcast where I, an internationally tolerated drag superstar, get to interview compelling and fascinating people about how they became who they are and why they do what they do. I'm very excited. Today we are joined by Emmy Award-winning actor and famous redhead, Carrie Preston. Hi, Carrie.
Hi, Jinx.
You did it.
How can I not?
How are you doing?
I'm so excited to meet you.
I'm so excited to meet you too.
I'm kind of geeking out because you played me.
I know.
In the Claws recaps for season one. And let me tell you how excited I was when they said that they were going to do that and that you were going to be playing me because you are one of my absolute faves from RuPaul's Drag Race.
This is blowing my mind.
I mean, absolute faves. And when we all the ladies were screaming when we found out who was playing us because we all know y'all. You know, we follow the show. We know who you are and everything. So we couldn't have been more excited. It was like we had all of our favorite rock stars were playing us, you know, in the biopic or something. It was fantastic.
That just blows my mind to hear because I was, you know, very excited when I got the call. You know how everyone always says, when I got the call, but it's all emails, you know.
And yeah, so, of course.
So I was just so thrilled. And while I was filming it, I was just like, I wonder what Carrie Preston would think about me playing her in this. And to now years later to get to meet you and to get to talk about it, I'll tell you some of the behind the scenes stuff. They had pulled a wardrobe for me that I'm sure the silhouettes and the style of dresses that they pulled would have looked amazing on your body and your frame, but for a curvy man-sized woman, I was like, we're gonna need to do something about the spaghetti straps, which is why I'm wearing a cardigan. I'm wearing a cardigan and everything because I insisted on something to go over the spaghetti straps.
Listen, cardigans, Polly rocked cardigans all the time.
Wonderful.
So, you know, you were right in there. No, I mean, I screamed and howled. Like when you did that cupcake scene, which is, you know, one of my all-time favorite scenes.
Oh, the knife throwing?
Yeah.
That's so brilliant. And I mean, it's one of my favorite things to do filming is throw something or like, you know, break a glass or something. It's like the thing you don't get to do in theater.
Yeah.
So to have that prop knife and just throw it into the air over and over.
Right. And then of course they cut to it being, you know, it sticking in the ceiling.
Yeah.
But when we were shooting it, you know, you throw the knife and it falls back down. I mean, there's no way. So they had to like cut every time, you know, as like, be careful. We don't want the, of course it was a fake knife, but you know, the one I was throwing, but yeah.
Your knife throw in that scene. I mean, I wanted so badly to capture the essence of that. How many times did you have to film that? So for anyone listening who hasn't seen the scene, you're threatening another character in the show while you're frosting cupcakes. And then as a show of your strength and as a show of why not to fuck with you, you take this giant butcher knife and throw it, and then it sticks into the ceiling and it's an amazing moment. How many times did you have to film throwing that knife into the air?
It's so funny. I mean, of course, you know, when you're shooting a scene like that, it takes, you know, the better part of half a day, you know what I mean?
Yeah.
Because you have to shoot the master and the close-ups and all that stuff. So we saved the actual throwing of the knife, you know, till the close-ups and stuff.
Yeah, yeah.
And then they would, you know, use it, the insert later, which so I didn't even see what that looked like until it came out. And then I howled because if they really looked so convincing. I mean, it really looked like I threw that knife and it stuck in the ceiling. And then to see you do it was truly delightful. Yeah.
Oh, it was an honor to get to recreate that moment. Fans of Carrie Preston will recognize her from many different projects. True Blood, The Good Wife, and we were talking about Claws. And Claws is an amazing ensemble cast. And it stars Niecy Nash. And I love when comedy actors, you know, like who are known for something as cult as Reno 911, like then transition into doing something you'd never expect.
Yeah, I know. She's really incredibly versatile. And I don't know if you saw Getting On, which was on HBO that she was on. And she, you know, it was just this really subtle performance from her, and you know, she got nominated for Emmy, and you know, she just you know, it has had like a really interesting career, you know, doing anything from the kind of reality shows all the way to, you know, Claws and everything in between. So you know, I admire actors like that. That's, you know, that's the kind of actor I try to be too.
Oh, I would agree. I mean, to go from vampires to nail salons, you know, you have to have some versatility there, I'm sure.
Yeah.
And you've worked on all sides of the camera. You directed some episodes of Claws. Mm-hmm. You mentioned in our little pre-recording meeting, you're a filmmaker yourself.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
And then you're an actor as well. What position do you enjoy playing the most, or do you like to be able to flip-flop, as we say in the gay community?
ACDC. You know, I guess what you might call a lifer. You know, I started doing you know, my own like theater when I was in the seventh grade. I started my own theater company, you know, out with the kids in the front yards. We called ourselves the ST kids, the street theater kids. And I was, you know, I had everybody out there, all the kids. And, you know, I was writing the skits and, you know, we were singing songs. And then we would, you know, I was already an entrepreneur and I was charging people, you know, 50 cents or whatever to come and watch it. And, you know, we would sell lemonade and, you know, it was a thing, you know, and I was doing community theater and all of that. But I always knew that I wanted to do more. You know, we didn't have a drama department in my high school. So, you know, I started one, you know, so that we could do plays there, you know. And I just have always been somebody who wants to make things. I like to make things, you know. So I've tried to, you know, carry that into my adult life and continue to do that. And you know, I started my own production company with a couple of my friends when, you know, it was right at the beginning of that kind of do-it-yourself filmmaking, you know, when people were taking cameras in their own hands and making movies with, you know, these little prosumer cameras, you know, those mini DV cameras. And, you know, and I started working with them and we would make these feature films, and we would somehow cut them together, and they would go to festivals, and then we would, you know, like it was that kind of thing. And then I knew I wanted, you know, to move that into directing television, because I love being on TV, and you know, so it felt natural that I would want to try to get behind the camera and in that medium as well. So, but acting is always the thing that, you know, I keep coming back to. You know, it's the first love.
Yeah. And I always say for myself, I can relate to your stories of putting on your own shows in your yard and stuff.
Yeah.
Like my after school job was busking on the streets of Portland, nice. Doing a mime act that I did with a friend of mine. And we called ourselves the Street Dolls because
there you
we
go.
Would dress up like wind up dolls. And we'd have a boom box, and we were, you know, we were doing drag numbers, but all the songs we selected for it were something having to do with like being dolls or wind up dolls or whatever. And, you know, we would make $60 each in a couple of hours. That's all I needed to get by on back then.
Oh, God. But... yeah. That's a fortune.
Yeah. When you're 15, $60 for a week, that's your lunch. That's your lunch, breakfast, and dinner. So I've always thought it was a huge, probably like one of my best, my biggest benefits in life is that I've just always known what I wanted to do, and mm-hmm. then to be lucky enough to be doing it these days. And you went to Juilliard. You graduated in 1994.
Yeah.
What was that experience like? I've always wondered, because Juilliard holds this weight to it. Did you feel like a pressure to be Juilliard?
Everyone always makes fun of the Juilliard actors, you know, the ones who have the deep voice and everything and all that supported work from the classical plays and stuff. It took me a couple of auditions to get into Juilliard. I mean, I knew, you know, I wanted to go there. I didn't know if I could get in, you know. At that time, they were really only taking around 7 women a year, and then the rest were men. They didn't really do like a half and halfy thing that they think they do now, because they were still sort of under the, I think false impression that classical plays have more men than women in them. So we need to have more men in the classes than women.
Yeah.
And of course that has changed so much, and we have such non-traditional casting, some of which I'm lucky to have been a part of. We'll talk about that in a bit, but I had gone to a small college, the College of Charleston, mm-hmm. at first. You know, my parents, they didn't really know. Like, I knew I wanted to be an actor. My older brother is an actor as well. But they didn't really know. It's not like today where the parents, you know, take you to colleges and they show you, my parents were just like, figure it out. We'll be supporting you however you want, but good luck, you know.
Yeah.
And they were very supportive, but, you know, they didn't really know. So it took me a minute, you know, to find my way. So I went to this smaller college, and then I had a professor there who was like, said, why don't you try to go to this other liberal arts college that he had gone to, and it was in southern Indiana, called the University of Evansville, which sounds like, you know, a really small school, and it was, but it had a really wonderful theater training program, and a lot mm-hmm. of great people have come out of it. Actually, even on True Blood, Rutina Wesley, who played Tara, she went to school there. Rami Malek, who, you know, is the Academy Award winning actor now. He went there after me. So, you know, it's got a nice track record. But my professor at the time, I told him I wanted to go to Juilliard. And he said, well, if you come to the University of Evansville, I will get you into Juilliard. And I was like,
oh, really?
Oh, well, that's a big thing to say, you know. And so I went there, and they really trained us, you know, to how to audition, you know, mm-hmm. for these schools, these like high powered schools. So I had auditioned for Juilliard, you know, when I was younger and hadn't gotten in. And so when I got done with Evansville, I auditioned for Juilliard and got in. And then I told him, I called him up and I was like, I got in. And he was like, whew, oh my God. I'm never going to say that ever again to another kid.
Just keeping him up at night.
He was keeping him up at night. So, but yeah, to answer your question, it was, it was a lot like acting boot camp, you know?
Yeah.
It was really intense. I wouldn't trade it for the world. It was an incredible, mm-hmm. Stomping ground. And it was a way for me to move to New York City and acclimatize myself to this town. I don't know if I would have been able to just cold move here, To be able to move here and be in this like womb of training with these incredible professors and, classmates that were all, in it together and creating, being creative together. That was pretty great. It was also really intense, we called it the jail yard school, instead of the Juilliard school, we called it the jail yard school. And like, even now when you meet people, who went to Juilliard, you're just like, hey, yeah, we went to NAMM together, man. It was like, we survived,
That's Drag Race girls, that's our shared, our shared experience that links us no matter who we are or whether we went at the same time. Mm-hmm. And I went to acting school for college, Cornish College in Seattle, mm-hmm. and they pride themselves on like delivering a conservatory style education, mm-hmm. Then you get a BFA. So it's a university setting with a conservatory style education. Right. And it was very much like, it's all you do for 4 years. My weekends were spent working on the projects. I was in shows after school. I spent every day, all day. And I made some of the most amazing friendships there and people I still collaborate with today. And mm-hmm. the biggest thing they taught me was, if you don't see the work out there for you, if the role, mm-hmm. If you're not getting the roles you want, they taught us how to kind of create the roles we want to see out in the world or create the work we want to see in the world. So mm-hmm. I had, when I went to acting school, I thought I wanted to just learn how to be an actor. But now knowing how to do some writing and, having a little approximate knowledge of directing and producing and stuff, it's definitely served me in my work because, there's not a wealth of gender non-binary drag roles out there. And when they do exist, they tend to still go to just pretty boys anyway. So.
Oh, God, I know. It's so crazy. But that's why it's so great that everybody can just take the work into their own hands now.
And that's the work that's, I feel like, being celebrated a lot today. All my favorite shows, the cast are also the people who created it. It's Always Sunny in Philadelphia was self-generated at first, and mm-hmm. Broad City, and Pen 15. There's so much amazing work that's coming out of intense friendships and people just saying, okay, if no one's going to make this show for us, we'll just have to make it for ourselves.
Yeah, exactly. That's what you have to do. And you can now. I mean,
yeah.
Andy Warhol wasn't wrong, right? Everybody's getting their 15 minutes.
So you went to Juilliard, which meant you spent some time living in New York. Do you live in LA now?
No, I'm New York all the time.
Oh, you're in New York.
Yeah, we lived in my husband and I, we had a place out there for a good long time in LA, but then there's so much work that's happening all over the country. And I was True Bloodshot in LA, mm-hmm. so I was there for quite some time. And my husband was on Lost. My husband is Michael Emerson, if you don't know, and he was on Lost, which was this, kind of cult hit. But
I've heard of it.
Lewis. But it was shooting in Hawaii. So when he got that job, and I was in New York doing theater, I mean, that's a little bit of a commute, you know?
Yeah.
The New York, Honolulu, you know, it's just not an easy place to get to. That was, you know, when I started spending more time in LA. So at least I could, you know, commute mm-hmm. to see him. And when I was shooting True Blood and he was shooting that, then it was just easier to get to each other that way. Yeah. I love LA though. I long to be back there again. It's just, you know, I just kind of have to go where the work where the work takes me. Yeah. Like, you know, Claws shot in New Orleans. Love New Orleans. Great town. You know, and I loved being there. And I feel lucky that I've gotten to work kind of all over in cool places and even right here at home in New York City.
Yeah.
Or as Dina Martinez says, New York shitty.
Yeah. And you know, Dina, you really are a drag fan.
Oh, she's like the drag art, you know, like you. You guys are you're artists with your drag.
Well, I lived in Seattle for 12 years, so I got to know Dina's work in Seattle, but we got to become friends doing our summers in Provincetown every year.
Oh, of course.
And Dina is definitely one of the drag geniuses, part of the old guard of drag before there was a TV show dedicated to drag. I absolutely agree with you. Like when work takes you around the world and you get to like plant in a city for a while and pretend like you live there for a while, it's really amazing. Mm-hmm. And it's like, I love working in London. I love working in New York and LA, but I always love knowing when I'm going to be done too, because they're just a little bit too much city for me. Oh, I was born and raised in Portland and I live mm-hmm. in Portland, Oregon again. And I just don't, I think I have a capacity for how much city I can handle at one time.
I feel you. It is something that you do have to, you know, it costs $20 to wake up when you live in New York City. Just, you know, and you're just assaulted by humanity, you know,
assaulted and you could be in your, admittedly I was, when we did a show off Broadway in New York, we were staying in an apartment in Hell's Kitchen because mm-hmm. we wanted to be like walking distance from the theater.
Yeah.
And it would be 4 a.m. and the city's still partying. Nice. And I'm like, I was, you know, like in my mid-20s and I wanted to open the window and be like, quiet down, you kids, I'm trying to get some sleep. Admittedly, I don't know much about Macon, Georgia.
Macon.
Mm-hmm. What was the shift from, you grew up in Macon, Georgia, what was the shift from Macon to New York? Did you feel shocked?
Oh, yes. Oh, my gosh. Yes, yes. I mean, I knew, you know, being in Macon, even when I was a little kid, I remember driving around in the backseat and looking out and going, I think there's a lot more to the world than this. Like, I just sort of knew it. Not that I don't love Macon. I do. And I loved growing up there. My mother is an artist and an art therapist and, you know, was always very encouraging of, you know, finding our passion and following our heart and, you know, really encouraging us to explore all the arts. And so, you know, like I said, my brother's an actor. My sister is a librarian. She's the head of acquisition. She's the head of acquisitions at Fashion Institute of Technology here in New York. So she's a cool librarian, you know what I mean? Yeah. And she worked at the Metropolitan Museum of Art in one of their libraries mm-hmm. Before that. And so we're all just kind of steeped in the arts. But I remember the first time I visited New York City, New York shitty, I thought, wow, how do people live here? You know, it was inconceivable to me. It felt overwhelming. The anonymity the potential anonymity really scared me, you know.
Walking down the street, yeah, feeling like you are like a fish darting in and out of predators, like, yes, eye lines. It's like, I, yes, I always think about the like the scenes in Finding Nemo where they're like, you know, like dodging the bullets and the shark is behind them and you have, uh-huh, to like find openings and gaps to like squeeze yourself into.
Oh, gosh. Yeah. And it was just, you know, they're just like, it's just dirty, you know, and there's trash everywhere, and, you know, and I just thought, why? But then, you know, I would go to the museums and I would go to the mm-hmm. theater, and then I would think I would really love to be a part of that and have that in my, yeah, life on a regular basis, you know. But like I was saying before, if I hadn't gotten into school here, I think it would have taken a little bit longer, you know, for me, yeah, to want to move here. You know, I, yeah, I just really wanted to, you know, make my living as an actor on stages. It didn't have to be Broadway, you know, it could be,
yeah,
anywhere. And I started, yeah, doing, you know, summer Shakespeare and stuff when I was a freshman, oh,
nothing
in college.
Like, nothing,
and,
like, you know, summer Shakespeare. Uh-huh. Did you do it out in the parks?
I did,
Shakespeare,
well, yeah,
in the park.
I did it. But it was like, you know, Georgia Shakespeare Festival. We were under, yeah, a tent, you know, on a field. And, you know, I started off as a little apprentice and I was getting paid, you know, yeah, my $50 a week or whatever to, yeah, you know what I mean? And I was thrilled, you know, to carry the spears and help build the sets and,
yeah,
work in the box office and all that. So moving to New York was it was a big dream that I didn't even know I had until I got, yeah, here, and it took some adjusting, you know, once,
yeah, I am going to ask a fairly crude question.
Okay,
feel free to answer however you feel comfortable answering, but the first time I went to New York for an extended amount of time was a show I had written was playing off Broadway at the Laurie Beachman Theater.
Yeah.
And we ended up getting extended. So we lived there for like 4 months. Mm-hmm. And my best friend, who was working as our tour manager, and my music partner, both separately had experiences where they were walking down the street and someone just stopped in front of them, pulled down their pants and started shitting on,
oh,
the,
yeah,
ground.
100%. Mm-hmm.
And I felt kind of jealous because I was like, I can't even imagine what that feels like to witness that. And, mm-hmm, then I felt like I wasn't really like acclimating to New York because I had never seen someone just like shitting on the ground. And when it finally happened for me, I felt like I'm a real New Yorker.
Oh, you're
now.
You're a New Yorker. Yes. You've been shit on.
Have you witnessed someone,
sure,
just fully defecating in the middle of the road?
Fully. 100%. Oh, more than I care to even. It's seared onto my eyeballs. Too many times. I've seen that. I've seen, you know, people swinging free and easy, if you know what I mean. Just,
oh, yeah.
What?
Well, we have that in Seattle,
the hell?
Too.
Yeah.
When I lived in Seattle, like, I was just like at a crosswalk one day and I looked up from my phone and there was just a fully nude man. The only,
yeah,
thing he was wearing was a sweatband on his thigh and his sneakers.
Yep. Mm-hmm.
And what I love is that it fazed absolutely no one.
No one.
No one was looking at him. No cars were stopping. And he was just,
no,
jogging down the street in full nudity.
Yeah.
Which, mm-hmm, I found to be quite the blessing to witness that. One of your earliest films was My Best Friend's Wedding,
yeah,
which is also, I think, has a cult following. And I'm sure everyone, I know, I don't know how old I was when it came out, but I remember my mom renting it at the Hollywood Video back, mm-hmm, in the day when you, mm-hmm, had to go rent,
yeah,
movies.
Yes,
and it was such,
course,
an experience to go and walk the aisles and pick out your movie.
Oh, I love
and
that.
I remember, you know, I was young and one of the main characters in it is gay. And I had like never thought about Julia Roberts' mm-hmm. date to the wedding as a gay, mm-hmm, man. Yes.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And you know, I remember, since I knew I was queer my whole life, it always was exciting just to see that there was like a queer character in a film or a TV show. Yeah. And that's why the Say a Little Prayer scene of everyone at the table singing Say a Little Prayer is, you know, it's I can access that memory at the drop of a hat. What was it like working on that film, which is stacked with actors who have done just countless things since that film? What were some of your favorite moments about that project?
I was, I mean, I felt like I won the lottery just getting cast, you know, in that movie. And I certainly, we had to go through our paces, you know, in the audition process, because it was a big, you know, that was back when they were making big Hollywood rom-coms, you know, and it was, you know, it was, those were like the big, big blockbusters, you know, those movies. And Julia Roberts, you know, was at the height of her Hollywood sweetheartness. And she was a fellow Georgian. So I was excited to meet her because she's, you know, a Georgia girl and we're the same age. And, you know, it was like, wow, she's, you know, got this incredible career. And then to watch her work, I mean, you understood why she had that career. You know, she was a total pro and she would just execute those scenes like unbelievably easily and made it seem effortless, you know. And PJ Hogan, who was the director, I mean, I think he really took that script and he put all those things that you were just talking about. Mm-hmm. I don't think that Rupert Everett's character in the original script was supposed to be gay. Oh, I think that was PJ, the director, who was like, no, we got to do something. We got to make this a more interesting character. And then Rupert Everett, you know, is so great. And there was a sense of play on set. Like there was a sense of us being allowed to kind of, you know, make those roles into something more delicious and more specific to who we were. And certainly with that character that you love so much. And then shooting that scene, the Say a Little Prayer scene, again, that was PJ. Like he added that whole thing. He wanted it to be a big musical number. And it took us two, like 14-hour days to do that.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. And makes sense. you can imagine what the lobsters were smelling like on day two. You can imagine what that room. And it was hot. We were shooting, you know, in the summer. It was hot. But it was delightful, you know, to be, and we were shooting on film. This was, you know, we were not shooting on digital where you get to do a million takes, you know, we're shooting on film. And, you know, those were the days where they really needed to know exactly what the shots were going to be because they didn't want to burn all that film up. And, but to be able to just, you know, have that sense of being in a musical when that is not what I do. I'm not a musical theater girl. I wish I was. And it's funny because in the movie, it's half of the performance is my voice and then half of it is not. I'm definitely lip syncing at the end at the wedding. I was very happy that they kept at least some of my singing in that scene in particular. And then that's Rachel Griffiths, who's with me and, you know, playing my sister.
And, who was also in Muriel's
Wedding.
You terrible Muriel.
terrible Muriel.
Do you enjoy being part of a duo? Pretty much all of my work is with a collaborator. Like, I mean, even my solo shows, my music partner's on stage and I end up always, you know, I am always like set out to write a solo show, but I always need like the foil and the straight man to be on stage with me so that I'm not just, I'm not fully talking to myself or fully talking just to the audience. I need someone to be able to interject and like give me the next thing to talk about. So I always write him a bunch of lines into all our shows. And some of our shows, it's very much the two of us, like 50-50. So people are coming to see a Jinx show and then they get treated to a Jinx and Major show, whether they know it or not. So
Well, I think that's great. I don't think I could do I wouldn't want to do a solo thing. And I certainly had never had any ambitions to be a stand up or anything like that. I am definitely a collaborator. Yeah. So yeah. To answer your question, yeah, I do like, you know, to have people to bounce things off, you know, of and yeah. to work with and create things together. My producing partners, there's three of us, you know, it's we're, you know, we're always, you know, trying to figure things out together. And even when I'm, you know, being asked to direct something, it's never a solo thing. You know, it's, yeah. you have to be able to work with a whole bunch of people. And that thrills me. I like that.
Yeah. I've always, especially, you know, most recently, for the last, we're about to do our fourth year of writing a holiday show together, Ben De La Creme and myself. And then
yes.
last year in quarantine, we put out the Jinx and De La holiday special. Mm-hmm. And I realized that all of my best work happens when I'm doing it with someone else, because I feel like if I were just left alone to my own devices, there would be nothing to kind of like pull me back to what other people can relate to. Mm-hmm. I'd yeah. stay so far steeped in just like what I find interesting that no one would have access to it. So yeah, I think collaborators are extremely important, even if they're not on camera with you. You know, I don't think any good work is done without like a whole village coming in to like put their two cents into it.
Yeah. And I mean, I know it sounds trite to say that acting is reacting, but I really do find that to be true. Like if you're working on a scene and you maybe get a little lost, you don't know, you know, what the scene is asking of you. If you just make the scene about the other person, mm-hmm. you're good. You're golden. You know, it's yeah. just like it's a little trick that I, you know, share with the younger actors who ask me, you know, what's the trick? And I'm like, the trick is, you know, put your energy on someone else and then they will be giving you. And if you're both doing that, you're going to be giving each other all the right things to make the engine turn. And
oh, yeah. And it just feels, I mean, like I feel daunted, like, learning a monologue, or I've done Hedwig and the Angry Inch, and I feel like I don't know how I ended up memorizing that show because it's just Hedwig talking the whole time.
Oh my gosh.
And no one else in the show has any lines. And for me, I can memorize a scene where it's me and another person or me and other people. I can memorize that scene like in two read-throughs because I know mm-hmm. as long as I'm listening to what everyone else is saying, my brain is going to remember what my character wants to say in those moments. Mm-hmm. But right. monologues, I mean, like Ooh. Monologues, like call me in a month and we'll see if I have it.
Yeah, exactly. Those are tough. But I bet you were great in that. I wish I would have seen that.
It's a lot of fun. It completely killed me. Like I had no energy for anything other than doing Hedwig and the Angry Inch and then sleeping until I had to wake up and get back into costume.
Of course. That's a tour de force. Yeah.
Yeah, it was a lot of fun, but I definitely prefer to be part of an ensemble. My favorite role to date is I played Velma Von Tussle in Hairspray in Seattle for the 10-year anniversary of, because it was developed in Seattle before it went to Broadway. And yeah. that show, I had never really got, lots of times I don't get into a show until I'm auditioning for it. And uh-huh. then I fall in love with the show through the rehearsal process. And then that yeah. show, you know, like lives inside of me for the rest of my life. But
mm-hmm. I know what you mean.
An eclectic taste in musicals. You know, you say to someone you're a musical theater actor and they expect that you know every last musical. And I'm like, no, I know like a bunch of Sondheim stuff, some, I know Rocky Horror.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't
and then
know.
The shows that you were in. Yeah.
And then the shows I was in, and that's it. So I want to ask you about this show, and I remember this show. I think I remember seeing the commercials. I don't know if I saw it. It's amazing I have any memories past last week, honestly. but you were on a show in 2001 called Emeril that had seven episodes and then was pulled from the air. And this was a show that starred Emeril Lagasse.
Yeah.
And it was during a time, I remember there was just an era in TV where half the shows that were on TV were just about the it was like the actor who's playing the main character, the person playing the main character, and then a fictionalized version of their life.
Right.
Like, I was devastated when Bette was canceled because I actually loved it. But it was the same thing. It was just Bette Midler playing herself in a fictionalized version of her life. What was it like on the set of Emeril? And what are your hypotheses for why the show didn't make it past 7 episodes?
Well, Emeril, God bless him. He's a wonderful guy. He's not an actor. He wanted to be. He tried really hard. I mean, he was really actually very game. But no, that was the strangest time because, well, first of all, I was thrilled because, you know, I was living on theater money. And so, you know, to get a job like that was like, wow, okay, I can actually, you know, make a living instead of scraping by and doing the day job and all that stuff. And so I was thrilled to have that job. But a sitcom, a 4-camera sitcom with the live audience, I always say, you know, it's a comedy, but it's no joke. It is very serious. They take that very seriously. And it's like high pressure, you know, to be funny all the time. And so we started that show, and then 9/11 happened while we were filming. So, we were actually on a week when you're shooting on a sitcom. The reason everybody or a lot of actors like to do sitcoms is because the schedule is so incredible. You work 3 weeks and then you have a week off. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I use the word, you know, work kind of loosely because, you know, even the hours during the week are really great. So it's like great for people who have kids, but I don't have kids, but so you have these 3 weeks on and a week off. So, because I lived in New York, I would try to go home on those weeks off. So I had gone home. My husband had been out with me. He had gotten nominated for an Emmy for best guest actor in a drama for this show called The Practice. Mm-hmm. He won, and we went home for my hiatus. He carried an Emmy onto the plane on September the 10th.
Oh, wow.
Yep. And we landed, and then we, you know, went to sleep in our apartments, and we woke up and the whole world changed.
Yeah.
And then I had to get back out to LA because we were still shooting. Mm-hmm. So there were no planes. Everything was grounded. Yeah. I certainly wasn't getting on the PJ, the private jet for NBC. Yeah. I was not I wasn't that kind of a star. And so, you know, it was like they were going to write me out, you know, the episode, you know, of that next episode. And I was like, oh, hell no. I need that money. You know, I'm getting out of here. So I rented a car with a friend. I swear it must have been the last car in Manhattan. I'm not kidding you. And we drove across country.
From New York to LA?
From New York to LA. And it was actually an incredible time to see our country, you know, because everywhere we stopped, we had New York plates. And people would be like, how are y'all doing? You know, here, do you want a coffee? How are you feeling? You know, let the meal's on us. Like, everybody was so rallied around around New York and it was a really, you know, profound thing to experience as well, you know, to see our great big country after it had been attacked. And then I went back, you know, to shoot some more of this sitcom, you know.
Yeah.
That, what did that have to do with anything? You know what I'm saying? And so, but nonetheless, we ended up shooting 11 episodes of it. And then, you know, they canceled it. It started airing as we were still shooting. But it was after 9/11. And so people were just not, it was the wrong tone, you know?
Yeah.
Not that the show was great. you know, I was sad, you know, that it ended because it was a great job and I liked the people. But the best part was, you know, Emeril would get stressed. And so he would cook for us. And so you
I was just going to ask, like, yeah. did you get to eat?
Yeah, he would come in, set. You know, and he would be like, I couldn't sleep last night, so I made you guys a pot of gumbo. And he would like pop it down, you know, it's like, girls, do you like meat? Do you like meat? I got a porterhouse, you know, and you're like, yeah, sure. I'll So that was actually one of the perks of that job.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Wow. You have lived a life, Carrie Preston.
Yeah, well, I'm a little bit older than you, James. But yeah, I've been up and down.
Looking at us in the Zoom meeting, we basically look the exact same. I'm not going to ask you this question. I'm just going to say some things at you.
Okay.
But I am not a natural redhead. But since I was as far back as I can remember, and there's photos of me at like 3 years old and 4 years old, I've just always been obsessed with feminine energy and redheads. Redheaded females. It's like mm-hmm. been a lifelong obsession. So when I was 14, I started dyeing my hair, and I always wanted my drag persona to be a redhead. I had a blonde stint. When I won Drag Race, something in my mind said, I have to be blonde now. I don't know what. It was a crazy time. And then when I crowned Bianca, I went, no, I'm going to be a redhead now forever and ever and ever. And those pictures I was talking about, there's these pictures that exist of me as a toddler with a redheaded Barbie. And then I'm a little older and I'm just carrying around the head of the Barbie because the doll broke we couldn't get the head back on. But I didn't need the body because I just was concerned with the hair. So as a kid, I was carrying around this, you know, disembodied Barbie head just because she had red hair. What has life been? You're famously redheaded. What has life been for you as a redhead? Do people have certain expectations of you? Do people make weird assumptions based on you being a redhead?
Yeah, it's so funny because I've, had the great privilege of living up until about 12 years ago, you know, blonde. You know, I was born a blonde. I was born a blonde and... You know, I had a whole career as a blonde, and this is a very strange story. But my mother, for her whole life, used to have this recurring dream about a little redheaded girl that she had to protect. Yeah. And when I was born, the first image that she saw of me, you know, there was still some blood on me, and she thought I was a redhead. And then later on, I'm a blonde. I have no intention of being a redhead. I wasn't carrying around a decapitated redheaded Barbie. Although I did like, I think Dressy Bessie, was she a redhead? I did like my Dressy Bessie. But anyway, then I was doing True Blood, and I was doing a movie at the time where I was a blonde. And I got cast in True Blood, and the character's fully a redhead in the books and mm-hmm. everything. So they put a wig on me, and I liked it. I liked what I looked like as a redhead. And I was like, hey, that's pretty cool. And then because of the show, every season would pick up script-wise exactly where the previous season left off. So I kept having to wear the same wig. And then mm-hmm. I got really sick of the wig. And then I thought – finally, when there was a time jump in the script story, I said, I'm doing it. I'm dyeing my hair red. And mm-hmm. I did. And then I haven't looked back. I have loved it. It like just completely changed, you know, how I saw myself. It changed my casting. I started getting different kinds of roles, you know. Mm-hmm. I hate it that, you know, women are often just thought of as the color of their hair, but that does happen. But the redhead roles are more interesting.
It's so,
they're more fun. And
funny that you say that because it's so many years. I mean, you and Lucille Ball weren't working at the same time, but that's so similar to Lucille Ball started her career as a blonde, but she became who we know as Lucille yeah. Ball when she decided to go red. It's yeah. just so, I mean, of course, it's rooted in a flawed and systemically problematic system of all kinds of bullshit, but yeah, that a woman's life can begin again just because she dyes her
that's
hair,
red. I know, it's ridiculous. It really is. But also, like, the people who kind of check you out on the streets, mm-hmm. you know, strangers.
Oh,
it's
yeah,
a different type of person that likes a redhead than a blonde. I mean,
I got asked the other day, why did I choose to, like, this person didn't even for a moment entertain the idea that my hair was natural. Just a person walking by on the street just stops and says, why did you choose to turn your hair that color? And I said, because I felt like it. And he went, all right. And just kept walking.
Oh, no.
And I'd rather have moments like that as a yeah. redhead than to never have a moment like that as a brunette. I never felt like this is who I was meant to be when I just had brown hair. And I describe my natural hair color as the absence of color, because it's not just brown. It's like you would never like register me if I get my hair natural. Yeah. I would just be that person standing there. But enough about
honey,
our
I don't
red hair.
I don't want to know what's going on underneath this hair. Every time one root comes in, I'm like, get it out.
what was it like working on True Blood? I have to ask, are you one of those? Are you someone who likes horror? I know that Jessica Lange, who worked on many seasons of American Horror Story, has mm-hmm. said multiple times that she doesn't even like horror. So she doesn't watch mm-hmm. her work on American Horror Story, even though she is the backbone of the early seasons of that show. What was your relationship to horror? How did you find working on True Blood, an amazing show that rode the wave of the vampire craze and has multiple queer characters, lots mm-hmm. of diverse representation? Mm-hmm. Give us a little snippet of Carrie Preston's True Blood.
Well, for me, I was on a show about a bar. You know, everybody else was on.
So, absolutely.
Like, I was on this show about this quaint bar in a small town. And, you know, I was the human. And, I kept wishing that, you know, I would have more to do with the vampires, because, you know, the supernaturals, the soups or whatever, yeah. you know, they get to do cool things. They get to be a parts of, you know, the actors got to do stunts and they got to wear cool makeup and all of that. And, but I thought it was very important to have, you know, the character like Arlene to kind of hold down the context of the show,
yeah.
you know, that these were these supernatural characters that were existing in a very human and sometimes very conservative world, you know, and this,
yeah.
and this was a show that, you know, was popcorn for adults, but it was also, you know, a real statement on, you know, what it feels like to be disenfranchised in,
yeah.
in our society. And so yeah. I was very proud to be part of a show that had that kind of social commentary, but told
Absolutely.
In a way that was, you know, not tricking the audience.
Vampires and witches.
You know,
and
yeah, you know, vampire porn. You know what I mean? It was yeah. like people really, really responded to it in on many different levels. And I think that's what makes – you know, television or movies or anything that are that really, you know, hit. I think that's what it is that makes them work, is that it's they're, you know, they're serving many, many masters and somehow able to, you know, make a social commentary, but also to be highly entertaining.
Yeah.
And then I was, you know, thrilled of the arc of my character through the 7 years, you know, because she really was such a racist, you know, at the beginning, and it was fun to you know, try to humanize her, and you know, I grew up in Macon, and I grew up with complex women like Arlene, and so I felt like this real responsibility to portray the Southern a woman with, you know, with respect and with humor. And then to see that, you know, by the end of the series, she's ends up falling in love with a vampire. And so, you know, she got one of the best arcs of the whole series, in my opinion. Mm-hmm. And so I felt glad that I got to be there on day one and I was there on the last day, you know, a lot of people didn't get to make it all the way, you know, because it was
because people die.
To answer your question, I don't really watch a lot of horror. I do get scared pretty easily, but True Blood to me was more genre, you know, than horror or you know, it was not like a slasher or anything like that. It had many more nuances to it.
And it was sexy.
And it was sexual.
It was sexy, and you never knew who was gonna next be a vampire. And
no, there were lots of people turning vampire. Yeah.
Yeah. I'll admit, I'm big enough to admit if I were on a show like True Bloods, and did I say True Bloods?
Yeah, you did. It sounds like a gang.
If I were on a show like True Blood and I didn't get to play one of the supernatural characters, I would feel ripped off.
Yeah, it was tough, you know, like especially when it would come around to publicity time and it would be like,
yeah,
only supernaturals need apply to be on the poster, you know, and I was like, oh, okay. I fix you a drink while you guys get your photos taken?
If I were ever on a set where... Oh, it's like how I felt when, and this is no comparison to your to your experience, but when I played the Cowardly Lion in The Wizard of Oz in high school, and I got the role I wanted, and then they brought in the fly rig for the Wicked Witch. Ugh. And not only the Wicked Witch, but Glenda got to be on the fly rig too. Ugh. And I'm like, so pissed off that I didn't get to fly. I was like, can we write a scene where the lion, can we direct one of the scenes where for whatever reason, the lion is flying and it never happened. So I do get jealous when I see, oh, I want to be the one flying or drinking blood or...
Yeah, totally. Although that blood is not, it doesn't taste very good. And those harnesses that you have to wear when you fly are not comfortable. So I hope that makes you feel a little better.
Well, I've been tucking my dick for 18 years. I think I can handle a harness for a day. I want to ask, I have my closeout questions, but before I get there, I just want to ask if you can tell me some of your favorite roles. You mentioned earlier you've played some unconventional roles, and any of your favorite pieces you've directed, anything else that we haven't talked about that you just love for people to go out and Google search after this?
Well, the unconventional role was, this was like in the late 90s, and the Public Theater was doing a production of Antony and Cleopatra, and Vanessa Redgrave was directing and playing Cleopatra.
Oh, just Vanessa Redgrave?
Just Nessa. You know, I was asked to audition for, you know, there aren't very many women in the play. And I was asked to audition for this character called Octavia. And she's the sister to Caesar, right? Mm-hmm. So I went in, I was like, I'm not going to do a Cleopatra monologue for Cleopatra. So I'll just do... a Caesar monologue. I didn't do it in drag. I was, you know, wearing a dress, the whole thing. But I did a Caesar monologue and I end up getting cast as Caesar.
Oh, so, wow.
Yeah. So I get to cross dress and, you know, play a boy to Vanessa Redgrave. And it was pretty sensational, I have to say. It was pretty
that
great.
Sounds amazing.
And, yeah. I cut off all my hair and, you know, I wore boys' clothes all the time. And it was really, you know, a sensational, crazy, lawless production. So that was definitely one of the, you know, fun theater roles that I got to do. Yeah. And, as far as, film and TV. I mean, I've done so many wonderful things. I mean, Elsbeth Tassioni, who I play on who I played on The Good Wife, and then a little bit on The Good Fight, is one of those once in a lifetime kind of feeling roles, you know, that comes along and you just go, oh God, I hope I don't mess this up. It's so delicious and so good.
Yeah.
And so, you know, that was really fun to be able to, you know, play that over and over again.
Sorry to interrupt, but my brain is piecing it together.
Yeah.
Is The Good Fight with Christine Baranski?
Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Okay.
Yes. And it's a spinoff of The Good Wife, which is the one with Juliana Margulies.
Okay. Christine Baranski is
fierce,
amazing.
Yeah.
When I was 9 years old, we had to interview each other in, like, I don't know, like third grade, fourth grade. And I remember that, like, I outed myself in elementary school because every boy in class answered the question, who's your favorite actor or mm-hmm. actress? And mm-hmm. every boy said Jim Carrey, okay. Eddie Murphy,
right.
or like Mike Myers. Uh-huh. And I said Christine Baranski.
Yes. I love
and
this.
We actually wrote that as a line into the Christmas special that ended up getting cut as like the way to know that I was queer from basically the youngest age possible was my favorite actor as a child was Christine Baranski. So if you don't mind
that
texting
so
her
genius.
And telling her.
And I did just get to direct an episode of The Good Fight. So I got to direct her, which there's not much to say to Christine Baranski. Except, good job.
Good job, Miss Baranski.
yeah, you know what you're doing. That was an extraordinary experience. That just dropped about 3 weeks ago, the episode that I directed in The Good Fight.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah. And then I directed a feature film called That's What She Said that I would love people to go and find.
Starring Steve Carell.
It's not that. There's actually not a single man in the entire film. It's all women.
Oh, awesome.
Yeah.
I love hearing that.
Yeah.
It's been so lovely talking to you. You have
you too.
Wonderfully long and expansive and diverse career. and these are the questions that I ask everyone. So,
okay.
You know, just go with your gut, speak from your heart.
Okay.
Who, I know you're happily married. who is your celebrity crush? And I encourage you not to just say the person you're already married to, who
okay,
is also
no,
a celebrity.
I won't say that. I mean, I have so many. I mean, I guess I immediately go to the, like the, you know, the ones that I had from when I was younger, you know, like, well, I've always had the movie star boyfriend, Matt Damon. He's always been my movie star boyfriend. I mean, since I saw him in School Days. But then I go to like Annie Lennox. From Eurythmics. You know, I had her poster up. She had, talk about redheads. I mean, she had that short crew cut, you know, and the mask on her face and her arms up. And she had that voice of, and just, I was obsessed with her. And then I got to see her in concert a couple times, like camp out overnight to get tickets kind of thing. That kind of crush, you know, so, or like Sandra Bernhardt, you know, Without You, I'm Nothing, that movie, you know, like, so it's like talent crush, but also, you know, it's all wrapped up into, it's sexy,
you.
It's talent, it's the whole thing. Yeah.
I used to, when I started asking this question, I would like, you know, encourage people to say like, no, you're like, who would you do crush?
Right.
Until I interviewed Monet Exchange, and she took it to such a filthy place that I'm like, I'm just going to open this up. Whatever your interpretation of crush is,
of course, she did.
that's the correct answer. She said something about Goblin, something of Ryan Reynolds, and
oh, no.
I was like, this has gone to such a filthy place that I want to open up the parameters on this question.
Oh my God.
Also, I'll say my celebrity crush today is Rami Malek, because you mentioned him. He is so incredibly attractive and talented.
Rami's amazing, yeah.
I never watched the show. I can't remember what show. Oh, I don't remember the name of the show, but a sitcom that I never watched. But he plays a closeted queer character on the show who eventually comes out. And there's a supercut of all his gay moments on this show.
Are you serious?
I remember watching that on YouTube and just thinking, oh my gosh, he is so cute and so funny. And then another person who I think started out in comedy and now is like, you know, what? I'm not even going to take a stab at it, but I love it when comic actors then get to bridge in and show that like comedy is hard too. You know, just if you start out in comedy, that doesn't mean you don't have the capacity to be a serious actor. But then I also always feel like, oh no, we've lost another one when someone goes to the drama world and it feels like they're never going to come back to comedy. So.
Right. Well, I mean, I think comedy is way harder to do than drama.
Oh, that's because it is. But
it is.
Do you consider yourself spiritual?
Oh, yes, definitely. Mm-hmm. Definitely. I mean, I wasn't raised in the church, but definitely.
Congratulations.
I mean, being a Southerner, that is saying something.
Yeah, I was going to say.
Yeah, I had my little spiritual journey. Like I went to, you know, all my friends were, you know, Baptists and Methodists and stuff, and my grandparents, and I would go to church. I would do that. But I find that for me, it's Buddhism that, you know, really helps me the most as far as, you know, meditation and mindfulness training and that kind of stuff. And I really wouldn't be able to do what I do in this business, you know, to stick with it as long as I have without that, you know, because it could just keep you grounded. Yeah.
Yeah. And final one is, what is your go-to karaoke song?
Oh, Sweet Dreams and the Eurythmics.
Wonderful.
right back to Annie Lennox. Goes back to Annie Lennox. Yep, definitely.
I'll tell you Annie Lennox in the drag world. I've been doing drag since I was 15. I started in the dive bars, you know.
Sure.
Some drag shows, it was like, you know, we'd start at 8 and we'd go till midnight. So it's 4 hours of drag show and queens are coming through the bar or you've planned like your first 3 numbers, but you got 2 more numbers to do and you've totally forgotten what you wanted to do that night. Mm-hmm. There's this thing that's like legend in these dressing rooms where if a drag queen's like, oh, I don't know what number to do. I didn't bring the right wig for this. I know what I'll do. Pulls off her wig and goes, I'll just do Sweet Dreams by Annie Lennox and just go out with my bare head. Yes. I've seen that happen countless times where a queen's like, I don't know what to do. Oh, I'll just do Sweet Dreams, and pulls off her wig and goes out in her out of drag hair and does Annie Lennox. It's never stops being funny when you witness
it. There you go. Yeah. There she's just a legend from top to bottom.
Anything you'd like to plug or promote for our listeners right now?
Well, I would love for people to watch that episode that I directed of The Good Fight. It's the 7th episode of the 5th season. I'm very, very proud of that. And then Claws, the final season, will be airing at the end of the year. So it took a long time because of COVID to finally put it out. But I'm very happy to be able to share that, because that was one of the most extraordinary experiences of my career. So I was sad to see it end. And I'm glad that we get to have one final season to share with the fans.
Congratulations on everything. Thank you so much for being on this podcast today, Carrie Preston.
It was my pleasure.
It really feels like a merging of alternate universes or different timelines, having played you once years ago, but now here we are on a podcast together.
Now we have to be sisters. That's the next thing.
Yeah, that's got to be the next thing. Yeah. So we've put it out into the universe. Mm-hmm. No spaghetti straps for me. And I will say, when I had to have that wig made, like, I remember the offer coming through and then only having a couple days, and I didn't already have, I think they just assumed I already had a wig cut exactly like your hair, but I didn't. So I had a friend of mine do that wig up real quick. And something about when I was for the cupcake knife scene, when I was in the apron and the shirt I was wearing and the wig, I did not look like you. I looked like Patricia Heaton in the show, The Middle.
Well, I remember. Yeah, you could say that Polly's trying to be that kind of a person, you know, so that works. That works.
Yeah. I posted that picture and I said, how did I end up? I'm playing Carrie Preston and I ended up giving Patricia Heaton. And then she ended up commenting, you look great. Like, what is my life right now? Anyway, thank you much for being here today. I'm
Thanks
wishing you all
me.
The best. Thank you all for listening to Hijinks here on the Forever Dog and Moguls of Media Network. My name is Jinx Monsoon, and we have new episodes every Wednesday, so make sure you search for Hijinks on your favorite podcast app and hit subscribe. You can follow me at The Jinx on Instagram or Jinx Monsoon everywhere else. Where can they follow you, Carrie Preston?
At Carrie Preston.
There everyone. You go. Yeah. And I'll see you all next Wednesday for some more hijinks.
Bye,
and
Jinx.
And that's that.
Forever.
To listen to Hijinks ad-free and one day early, sign up for Forever Dog Plus at foreverdogpodcasts.com/plus. Make sure to follow at Forever Dog Team and at Mom Podcasts on social, and rate and review Hijinks 5 stars on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you get your podcasts. Hijinks is produced by Forever Dog and Moguls of Media, aka Mom, hosted by me, Jinx Monsoon, produced by Big Dipper, editing and sound design by Will Pitts, executive produced by Willem Belli, Alaska Thunderfuck, Brett Boehm, Joe Cilio, and Alex Ramsey.